Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Iranian nuclear ambitions and aid to Afghanistan were supposed to top her agenda, but on her visit to London today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has instead been forced to focus on Hamas, the militant group which swept the Palestinian elections last week. Rice and diplomats from the European Union, the UN, and Russia are debating whether to cut off contact and $1 billion worth of international aid to a Hamas-led Palestinian government. But that might further radicalize the Palestinian people and possibly empower Iran. Joining us on the line from London is Rula Khalef, Middle East editor for the Financial Times. And Rula, on her way to London yesterday, as Secretary Rice admitted, that she and others in the Bush administration were caught off guard by the Hamas victory. They didn't have the pulse of the Palestinian people. Your thoughts on her comments?
I think they weren't the only ones caught off guard by the results. I think, you know, even there's a very big debate within Israel itself now about why they didn't see this coming. And of course, you know, amongst the Palestinians, because, you know, even all opinion polls, all domestic opinion polls were showing that Hamas could do very well, but very well meaning less than a majority.
Right. Well, you call the Hamas victory an extreme test case for the Bush philosophy of transformation of the Middle East through democracy. What do you mean by that, and what do you think's at stake?
Well, the Hamas victory is part of a trend in the region. Whenever you do have a democratic opening, as we've seen over the past year, we see that Islamists tend to benefit more. And it's an extreme case because Hamas is in a situation where, you know, Palestinians don't yet have a state. They are also armed. This is not an Islamist movement like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which has become, you know, purely a political organization. So it makes it all the more difficult to have this test of Islamists in the political process and in government.
You quote a critic of President Bush's plan to, you know, democratize the region through elections, saying that the Bush administration is blind to the possibility that evil people can exploit democracy for evil ends. Is that the thinking, that perhaps these elections are coming too soon?
Well, I think this is one point of view, which I don't actually personally agree with. I think, you know, once you commit to democracy, you've got to be ready for all sorts of outcomes. And I think, you know, even though people didn't actually see the Hamas victory coming, it was clear to everyone that Hamas would do well in these elections. And Islamists are a political reality in the Middle East, so you cannot have any kind of democratic process while ignoring them. Now, it is true that in some cases there are a lot of things that could come before elections, and I think in a lot of cases what you need is a free political environment, space for Islamists and for secular groups to develop. And this is something that is not yet available in most Middle Eastern countries.
Well, and as we said, in the wake of the Hamas win, diplomats are debating what to do. The Palestinian Authority and the economy there receive roughly $1 billion from international donors, the EU being one of the largest. What are diplomats thinking? Are they thinking of a cutoff?
I think what diplomats are thinking is that there is a lot of financial assistance that is given to the Palestinians. They would like it not to go to groups that they don't, that, you know, they worry about their behavior, a group like Hamas that still is not committed to the existence of Israel. But I think at the same time, and this is a very big dilemma for the international community, because they can't possibly not be funding the Palestinians.
Because what would happen? I mean, how much is the Palestinian economy dependent on this aid?
A lot, and I think we've had a lot of warnings in the past few days that the Palestinians will not be able to survive without this aid. There's also aid from Arab countries, which hasn't been coming as swiftly as was expected. So I think what will have to happen today in London is, you know, warnings to Hamas that it needs to behave in a certain way if it wants the aid to go on. But I think also perhaps the search for a mechanism that would allow some financial aid to still go through. Let's not forget that not all international aid actually goes to the government. A lot of it, in fact, the bulk of American aid does not go to the PA. It goes to NGOs.
It goes to non-governmental organizations. Well, as we said, Condoleezza Rice is having dinner tonight with diplomats from the UN Security Council nations and Germany to talk about Iranian nuclear ambitions. We're going to have more about Iran in just a moment, but somehow we think that the dinner table talk will be more about Hamas. And is there a fear that cutting off funds to Hamas might lead that group and other Palestinians to run into the arms of Iran?
Well, I think, you know, as some Hamas leaders have said today, they think that they do have other options. And I think there are countries such as Iran who would be willing to step up their financial assistance if it's not coming from the European and American side.
Rula Khalaf, Middle East editor for the Financial Times of London. Well, as we said, today's meeting in London was originally supposed to focus on options for stopping Iran from producing nuclear weapons. 2 weeks ago, Iran announced it was restarting its nuclear program. Since then, Western powers, along with China and Russia, have been trying to resolve their differences in order to present a unified front on Iran. Pressure to find a diplomatic solution is building since Israeli officials suggested last week that they may resort to a military strike on Iran's facilities if other options fail. Here in the U.S., a recent poll by the Los Angeles Times found that a majority of Americans support taking military action against Iran if that country continues to produce material that can be used to make nuclear weapons. Well, we recently spoke to two analysts about options for dealing with Iran's nuclear program. Patrick Clausen is Deputy Director for Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Karim Sajapour is an analyst with the International Crisis Group, who is from Iran and spends much of his time working there. I began with Karim and asked him to explain what the U.S. can do to make sure Iran doesn't move forward with its nuclear program.
There's various tools, I think, at the disposal of the international community, particularly the European Union and Americans. I think the first step probably would be a referral to the Security Council to send a message to Tehran that, you know, this is a very serious matter and we don't plan to acquiesce on it as we have, you know, perhaps in the past. I think one thing that's very tricky is, you know, combining sticks and carrots. And you don't want to send a message to Tehran at a time when the regime, and particularly this new administration with President Ahmadinejad, has been behaving very belligerently. The rhetoric has been very belligerent. It's very tricky to put incentives on the table that you haven't in the past, because you very well could be sending a wrong message to Tehran that this is what works with the United States and with Europe. If you behave, you know, irrationally, belligerently, project this incalculable image, that this is how you deal with the West. For a long time, there has been this debate taking place within Iran between conservatives and reformists. And the reformists have said, you know, we need to operate, we need to get ourselves back into the international community, operate diplomatically. And the conservatives have said that hasn't gotten us anywhere. What we need to do is project a very powerful image.
In fact, let's remind people, Iran's president has talked about wiping Israel off the map. He's been disdainful of any requests that he change his opinion on, you know, the nuclear program. And I want to ask you about another comment that the president made, saying that there was no such thing as the Holocaust. In fact, he even called for some kind of a symposium to illustrate that there was no Holocaust, that that's a fiction, that's a myth. Of course, there are people in other countries who say the same thing, but what does the average young Iranian think about that? And could you also describe the interesting relationship that Iran has with Israel, given that there are so many Jews who live in Iran?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'm glad you asked me that. You know, Iran does have the largest population of Jews in the Middle East outside of Israel. It was a very strong community prior to the revolution, about 80,000. Now you still have about 25,000 Iranian Jews living within Iran. And I would argue that the majority of Iranians don't look fondly upon Ahmadinejad's comments about Israel. You know, when you talk to people about this issue, they say, you know, this is a dispute between the Arabs and the Jews, and we don't have a dog in this fight. Why should we be sacrificing our national interests for the sake of the Palestinian cause when we have so many problems at home? Mm-hmm. You know, it's very, very interesting when you walk around Tehran and you compare it to other capitals in the Middle East like Beirut or Damascus or Amman. And when you go to newspaper stands, what's interesting is opposed to those Arab capitals where you have books being sold, such as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion or, you know, paraphernalia demonizing Israel, you don't see much of that in Iran simply because there's not a great market for it. Mm-hmm. You know, Iranians are not buying these types of books. If they want to see it, they turn on the state television. But in their free time, this is not a strong affinity they have one way or another for the Palestinian or the Israeli cause.
Patrick Claussen, I want to bring you into the conversation. How do you explain President Ahmadinejad's comments about wiping Israel off the map? Do you think these comments might be more for domestic political consumption rather than international posturing?
That's a disturbing possibility, which looks more and more likely every day, that in fact Ahmadinejad thinks that rekindling the revolutionary flame can be done if he wraps himself in the Iranian flag. If he uses patriotism rather than Islam, then he can get Iranians to rally behind the revolutionary cause.
Before we move on from this, is it possible that the current president of Iran is sort of losing favor even within his country, and that's the reason for some of these statements? Is it possible that, you know, Iran may take care of this problem internally?
Well, the president's calculus, if that's what it is, that a confrontation with the outside world is not such a bad thing, that could get him in trouble at home, and we could find that he's in serious political trouble this summer. He's also taking a hardline stance on domestic political issues, and that's causing some problems. There was just a bombing the other day, for instance, in Ahvaz, in the southwestern part of the country. But there's been disturbances among ethnic and sectarian minorities for several months now in different parts of the country, and a lot of dissatisfaction among intellectual circles about crackdowns by Ahmadinejad.
Well, but Israel and other countries may not be willing to wait for the president to be taken down internally, if in fact that's even a possibility. And what about the idea that in reaction to this strong language about wiping out Israel, Israel, for instance, may react first? Israel's defense minister seemed to threaten some kind of action against Iran if it proceeded with its nuclear program. And that moves us to the question, is there any sense of some kind of preemptive strike against Iran, either from Israel or elsewhere?
Well, on a preemptive strike, that would be way, way down the road unless Iran were going to do something provocative. Indeed, if at some point the Israelis felt that the diplomacy were not moving fast enough, then they might decide that they would want to take action on their own. But even in that case, they would almost certainly start with covert action first, because these nuclear facilities in Iran are highly complicated industrial plants that are quite subject to accidents. And if the Israelis can speed up those accidents, that would have the desired effect of slowing Iran's nuclear program without having an open confrontation with the Iranians. So covert action would be their first method of choice if they ever decide that diplomacy is not going fast enough.
That's Patrick Claussen. He's Deputy Director for Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We also spoke with Karim Sanjapour, an analyst with the International Crisis Group. We're going to continue our talk about what can be done to stop Iran from producing nuclear weapons. That's when we come back. Also later in the program, two deaths, a mother and her 9-month-old shot dead in Massachusetts. It's a story that's resonating in Britain. We'll find out why. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with our look at Iran's nuclear program and the question being considered by Condoleezza Rice and other diplomats in London today. What options does the international community have for stopping it? Recently, we spoke with Patrick Claussen of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and Karim Sanjapour, an analyst with the International Crisis Group. Sanjapour is Iranian and spends a lot of time in country. I asked him for his opinion. What do people there think about Iran's nuclear ambitions?
Well, I think there is a lot of concern at the popular level about the direction in which the country is headed. I think media reports of all Iranians being united behind this nuclear issue are a bit exaggerated. You do have people who feel strongly about it. It's an issue of national pride. But you also have plenty of people who are concerned, ambivalent, or simply uninformed. You know, as Patrick mentioned, this is a very complex technical issue, and to think that the average Iranian knows the distinction between enriching uranium domestically and importing it from abroad, I think is a bit overblown. Mm. But we have to remember that the overwhelming majority of the Iranian population is very young, you know, about two-thirds under 30. And I would say that the vast majority of them strive to, again, you know, be part of a country that re-enters the international community, has good relations with the West, good relations with the United States. So I think if this were presented to them, that either A, you can pursue a nuclear program at all costs, or B, make a compromise with the international community and still keep elements of the nuclear program, they would choose a second option.
Right. And by the way, who would sanctions hurt?
Well, it depends what type of sanctions. If we're talking about, you know, full-blown economic sanctions, obviously it's going to hurt the people as well. And this is, I think, what the international community, particularly the Americans and the Europeans, this is a task that they will have to take on. How do you punish the Iranian regime without punishing the people? I would say that the first step, if it reaches sanctions, which is, you know, also many months down the road, would be sanctions on nuclear technology. First, you know, cease cooperation on nuclear technology and then move on from there.
And Karim, you're an Iranian. And so, if you don't mind, Patrick, I just want to ask Karim a couple of questions about impressions that we have from outside the country. First of all, if you listen to a lot of conversations on talk radio and such, there are people saying, for instance, that something like mutual deterrence does not work with a country like Iran because Iranians, and I just heard this the other day, Iranians don't care if they die. What's your response to that?
Well, I would say that's an absurd statement, that the Iranians don't care if they die. I think you do have, you know, elements of the population that are with the regime. Like in any place around the world, you know, corrupt autocracies have their small minority of supporters. But again, I would argue that, you know, the vast majority of Iranians are very young, very youthful population, and the types of things they strive for, economic improvement, social freedoms, political freedoms, cultural freedoms. And I think as opposed to the Iran-Iraq war, when you did have this nationalistic euphoria come to the helm and many Iranians volunteering to support their country, if there were some type of a military confrontation, I think it's I wouldn't expect to see the same type of euphoria you saw two decades ago when the revolution was in its very early stages.
Yeah. And Karim, David Brooks, columnist David Brooks, writes that in all his conversations with senior administration officials, he's never heard them be so cautious about what they can do and what they can achieve than in their conversations with Iran. Why is that, do you think? And my first guess is Iraq is right next door.
Yes, I would say that, you know, the calculus of U.S. officials, I think, is definitely informed by what's going on in Iraq and the high prices of oil. Iran is a much larger country than Iraq. It's a much more difficult terrain, much larger army. And I think, you know, we have to take into account that American officials do appreciate the fact that the Iranian population is, by and large, the most pro-American, or perhaps we can say least anti-American population in the Middle East.
And it's not North Korea.
And it's not Korea. You know, there are agitations for greater democratic freedoms. There are agitations for political reform. And there is a hope that, you know, within, you know, the mid to near term, you know, future, that there can be a different type of government in Iran, representative democracy. And I think U.S. officials are very cautious and careful about the fact of, you know, not wanting to spoil this oasis of goodwill that currently exists. Mm.
Patrick, as you know, politicians in this country are split in both parties, some saying that Iran's president's comments have been so inflammatory that it's reminding them of, you know, Germany pre-Hitler and that something has to be done immediately. Others saying that it's inevitable that Iran's going to develop a nuclear weapon and politicians should concentrate on reform within the country. Where do you fall down?
Well, the question is, how can we speed up democratic change inside Iran and slow down Iran's nuclear program? And the great hope is that we can persuade the Iranian leaders to freeze their program, plus have enough controls on the access they have to technology, that we can slow down their nuclear program so much that that democratic change takes place in Iran in the interval. Now, I can't be sure that's going to happen, but it's sure worth a try. And so I would pour a lot more resources into encouraging democratic forces in Iran through modest steps like more broadcasting to Iran, as the government has made the news media there more under its control. There's more opportunity for us to broadcast. And also a whole variety of measures to press Iran to show what a high diplomatic price it's paying for pursuing its nuclear program.
Karim, what now?
Well, it's a very difficult question. I think that, you know, supporting democratic reform in Iran is a noble enterprise. But I think right now is a very difficult, it's a very sensitive time period, especially, you know, when you don't have any government-to-government relations with the United States. It's very difficult for the U.S. to support individual actors or parties or any type of reform within Iran. I am hopeful about the prospects for democratic reform in Iran in the long term. As I said, very young population that strives for a different type of system. But how and when that is going to take place is very unpredictable.
Karim Sajapour, an analyst with the International Crisis Group. Patrick Clausen is Deputy Director for Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Gentlemen, thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, ahead of the President's State of the Union address, we'll check in on political operatives out in the field getting ready for some heated midterm congressional elections. Also, we'll hear the music of the rock band Wilco and have a talk with the band's leader, Jeff Tweedy. That's tomorrow. Stay with us, more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. More than a week ago, on Sunday, January 22nd, the bodies of 27-year-old Rachel Entwistle, an American, and her 9-month-old daughter Lillian were found shot to death in their rented home about 30 miles west of Boston. The case remains a tragic mystery here in Massachusetts and in England. Rachel's husband, Neil Entwistle, described as a computer whiz and online businessman, remains in seclusion at his parents' home about 150 miles from London, while prosecutors here in Massachusetts say he remains a person of interest in the case. We're joined by Boston Globe reporter Donovan Slack. Donovan, first of all, I understand you're at the Entwistle home outside of London.
That's right. And I'm standing here looking at the front door with about two dozen other media representatives waiting for word from this family.
Well, we're also joined by Chris Biondi, managing editor of the Metro West Daily News in Framingham, Massachusetts. And Chris, quick question to you first. Authorities here have said that Neil Entwistle is a person of interest. What does that mean? Does that mean he's a suspect?
It does not, according to the district attorney, Martha Coakley, who has stricken the word suspect from her office. She says, you're either a person of interest or a defendant.
Well, Donovan, there in London, or outside of London, you've been camped outside the Entwistle home. When was the last time anyone saw him? And what do we know about a meeting that he had with Massachusetts investigators last week?
It's funny you should mention those together, because the last time anyone saw Mr. Entwistle, he was re-entering his home here at about 11:30 p.m. Friday night after returning from London. And there have been conflicting reports, but as our newspaper has reported, we have sources that have said that he, in fact, is refusing to cooperate with investigators. There was a meeting set in London last Friday that he was supposed to attend, and on advice of his lawyer, he did not.
And Chris Biondi, back here in Massachusetts, can you give us a timeline as much as you know it? When did Neil go to London, and when were the bodies of his wife and child found?
The district attorney has said that Neil Entwistle began traveling sometime Friday, and the autopsy has revealed that the Lillian Rose and her mother Rachel were murdered sometime between early Friday morning and sometime Saturday. The bodies were eventually found by police in the master bedroom under a pile of blankets on Sunday, early Sunday evening.
And we understand that the family was supposed to have a party Saturday night, and friends had come over and relatives had come over, and no one answered the door. And so they'd called police actually on Saturday, a day before the bodies were found.
Yeah, correct. The mother, friends showed up at the home for a planned, it was just a social gathering, informal gathering. And at the same time, mother called police because she was concerned. She had not spoken with Rachel since Thursday. And police went to the house, entered the house, actually, with the friends who had gathered there, looked around the house, even poked their head into the bedroom, saw the bed, thought it was just an unmade bed, called out to see if anyone was home, and left. And the officer reported that he found nothing unusual. They did a routine check of the hospitals and found nothing. And and left the home.
And Chris, I know that Rachel and Lillian's family really haven't spoken except through a spokesperson and statements, but they may have spoken volumes in the death announcement and funeral announcement.
Correct. In the wake is Tuesday night. The funeral is Wednesday. But in the announcements of the deaths, neither Rachel's nor Lillian Rose's announcements mentioned Neil at all. And in the family statement yesterday, the only allusion to Neil was the fact that Rachel had been such a wonderful wife.
And Donovan, back there in outside the Entwistle home in Britain, as it happens in these very public, very sad cases, they begin to reveal what had been previously private. And there's some speculation that the murders, the deaths, might be connected somehow to concerns about Neil Entwistle's online activity, including his offer to help customers set up pornography sites on the Internet. Can you shed any more light on that, Donovan?
Well, from this end, I can't shed too much light on that. I can tell you that that seems to be a focus of Massachusetts investigators, and that's certainly something they have said. The district attorney has said that that is something they're looking into very seriously.
Has he said anything? Has Neil Entwistle said, has there been any statement about, you know, why he's there, why he's not coming home for the funerals later this week? What has he said a thing?
Well, no, and quite frankly, that's why everyone is standing outside here hoping to hear why he's here when his wife and baby lay dead in Massachusetts. And frankly, it's something that's divided this little tiny former coal mining community. It's captured attention over here just as much as in Massachusetts and in the United States. And I think it's captured so much attention because there's so many questions left unanswered.
Right. What are the divisions there?
There are those who say, you know, it's natural that Neil come back here where he's surrounded by family and that he should stay here despite the funerals going on. It offers him a certain measure of protection that he's here in his native England. But then there are others who simply can't understand how he would leave. You know, how he could possibly leave his wife and child back home in Massachusetts. And the one thing that everybody did seem to agree on here was that there's a feeling he should be cooperating with investigators.
Chris Biondi, back here in Massachusetts, Donovan said he would be in England where he'd be safe. There's been some speculation that this might have been revenge on the part of one of his former clients. Again, this is all just speculation. But again, how much does this online business that he was apparently running have to do with that speculation?
The DA has said that those internet businesses are part of the puzzle. I know that eBay has turned over all the records associated with the Entwistle account to police for them to examine. And there were some complaints on the eBay site to sales that Entwistle did not deliver on. No threats, in particular some nasty comments, but no threats.
Mm. And Chris, how are people reacting in Hopkinton? I know the Entwistles hadn't lived there for long, and this, again, it becomes one of those cases, although profoundly sad for the family of this mother and daughter, also have people talking about how could it happen here?
Absolutely. It's a Hopkinton, obviously, a suburban town. The last murder in Hopkinton was about 11 years ago, and the range of emotions, shock, obviously, tired of the media camped out outside the neighborhood. Some neighbors were even upset that this home, this about a $500,000 home, had become a rental unit. And one neighbor we quoted, I believe, today saying, you know, this isn't an apartment complex, it's a neighborhood. Mm. Lots of sympathy, too. It's a horrible story, and the pictures just drive it home.
Chris Biondi is managing editor of the Metro West Daily News in Framingham, Massachusetts. We also spoke with Donovan Slack in England, outside the Entwistle home where Neil Entwistle is staying at his parents'. Donovan, any sense of when he might emerge?
No sense at all. His mother and his brother have been out to go shopping. As we reported, every time they leave their home, there's a mob of media, and they just are not saying a word. And it doesn't look at this point like they're going to anytime soon. But it's hard to say because no one anticipated him traveling down to London either.
Again, that's Boston Globe reporter Donovan Slack speaking to us from Worksop, England. You're listening to Here and Now. Oh, some sad news now. Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Wendy Wasserstein died today at the age of 55. She was best known for bringing the women's movement to Broadway. Plays like Heidi Chronicles and An American Daughter dramatized and humorized women's struggles to succeed in a man's world. A vocal presence on the New York art scene, Wasserstein brought a wry wit to her essays and commentaries. Here's some of that irreverence on display from NPR's The Connection shortly after 9/11.
A few days after September 11th, I thought I should go on News Center floor and say, look, I take responsibility for this because I'm single, I'm Jewish, I'm a single mother, I live my life wrong. Just say, Chuck, it's my fault.
Wendy Wasserstein made nudes outside of the theater with her decision to have a child at age 48 as a single mom. She never revealed the name of the child's father. Her most recent play, Third, closed on Broadway last month. And most important, she gave voice to and was beloved by women of a certain age for bringing their story to the stage and to the page. And joining us now to talk more about Wendy Wasserstein is Nicholas Martin, artistic director of the Huntington Theater Company in Boston. He recently directed a revival of The Sisters Rosenzweig at that theater. And Nicholas, I'm imagining a very sad day for you.
Yes, it's rough. It's a cataclysmic, really, and pretty serious for the theater as well, to have a year in which you've lost August Wilson and Wendy Wasserstein, and Wendy at such a young age. I'm glad to have given her a production that she loved, of her most wonderful play, but it's hard for everyone. You know, she was one of the most beloved figures in the theater.
Well, and why? Tell us why.
Well, because she, you can see it in the plays, you can feel it even in the rhythm of the plays, that her humanity is so unaffected. She is the most unassuming, really great playwright, I think, of the second part of the century. And I think that's in all the plays. I think she's been assailed for it. I think people saw her as either a causist, or as, you know, a jokester.
Yeah.
And in fact, she's much more serious and more telling work than that.
Right, and serious commentary about the world scene outside of her playwriting. But a personal comment here. She and I had just started a kind of a road show, as it turned out. We called it Two Shiksas Dishing. It was I would interview her at different Jewish community centers here in the Massachusetts area, and you know, we started out, the opening line was always me to her, funny you don't look shiksa, that of course being the Yiddish word for a non-Jewish woman. She of course being a leading voice for Jewish women. How much did her Jewishness mean to her?
Oh, a great deal. I think as she never tried to shake it, but she also never used it the way someone in every minority, if you wish to call it that, uses it. I mean, she never paraded it. It was just part of her. And I think her upbringing, which was intensely Jewish, Orthodox almost, told her everything and never lost her sense of humor.
Yeah. We want to listen again to Wendy Wasserstein, who again died today at 55. Here she is again from November 2001 with that mix of humor and seriousness that you talked about, Nicholas Martin, speaking on The Connection.
I think in the face of tragedy, even illness, your character doesn't change in some ways. I mean, you still have your point of view. Mm. It is horrible, but you're not going to, you'll see the world differently, but you still bring with it your perception. I mean, for myself, I think I am a comic writer. That's how I see the world. I mean, even under duress.
That's Wendy Wasserstein speaking in 2001. She ended her battle with cancer today in New York City. Nicholas Martin, artistic director of the Huntington Theater Company in Boston, thank you for joining us to remember a giant whose light has been dimmed.
May she rest in peace.
Thank you. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and in a moment, the poetry of making paper. But first, an update on ABC News anchor Bob Woodruff and his cameraman Doug Vogt, who were both injured in a roadside bombing yesterday while on assignment in Iraq. The commander of the U.S. Military Medical Center in Germany, where both men are being treated for head wounds, says Woodruff and Vogt are seriously injured but in stable condition. ABC President David Westin says Woodruff may be flown back to the U.S. as soon as tomorrow. Former NBC TV anchor Tom Brokaw told the Today Show this morning that Woodruff's wife had told him that her husband's brain swelling had gone down, but doctors are not sure if shrapnel pierced his brain. A witness to that bombing says Woodruff asked if he was alive and not to tell his wife before passing out. Well, finally today, we turn to something we're surrounded by but don't think too much about. Paper. From Post-it notes to the daily news, paper plays an unsung supporting role in our lives, and a dwindling one, what with the rise of digital archives and the paperless office. But Here Now's Sean Cole happened upon a poet who spends a lot of time thinking about paper, in fact, writes about the stuff she writes on. Here's Sean.
A few years ago, I was at a friend's poetry reading in Boston, and he was on a split bill with this poet named Xin Yi Pai. I don't remember a word of my friend's reading, but this one poem of Xin Yi's stuck with me. It's called Recipe for Paper, and it starts off like this.
1. Send legal briefs, failed attempts at love letters, and other confidential documents through a shredder. Soak overnight in a warm bath. Scoop handful of wet paper into kitchen blender. Add boiled daffodil stems, mashed into a pulp, then blend. Black tea leaves, garlic or onion skin, translucent stains of color, pulp until smooth as oatmeal. In a plastic tub, combine one part pulp to three parts water.
As soon as I heard this, I thought, you know, that actually sounds like it could work. So, since I had nothing better to do between holidays last month, I printed out the poem and took the instructions one by
one. Send legal briefs, failed attempts at love letters, and other confidential documents through a shredder.
Alright. Letters unfinished. Dear Anne, I'm going to pretend that the manual typewriter that Jake gave me still works. And dearest Erica, I'm writing to you after finishing reading your dear writing on Pauline. Okay. She and I went out for a while.
I used to go out with her.
Sort of had a crush on her. Okay. Here we go.
Soak overnight in a warm bath.
Should be good enough. Ow! Damn! My elbow in the sink. Ow. So, we'll just leave this here till tomorrow morning. It's the next morning, and I haven't taken a shower because my bathtub is full of shredded paper. So I'm a little grumpy.
Scoop handful of wet paper into kitchen blender. Add boiled daffodil stems mashed into a pulp.
Oh. I guess you need the boiled daffodil stems, huh? For some reason, I thought that was optional. Fish markets. Florists. I called around, but daffodils aren't going to be in season for a while. So I asked one florist if there was something I could use to substitute.
The wet bulbs? Paper white bulbs.
How apropos is that? I hadn't heard of paper whites before. They're like mini daffodils, and they're really beautiful. Or were. Okay, back to the directions.
Add boiled daffodil stems.
It smells like asparagus.
Mashed into a pulp. Then blend.
Okay, nothing is happening here. It's not moving around like it should be. Gonna add some more water.
Black tea leaves, garlic, or onion skin. translucent stains of color, pulp until smooth as oatmeal, in a plastic tub, combine one part pulp to three parts water.
And stir it up. And we have now succeeded in making a mess.
Or more specifically, a plastic tub of greenish vomit-looking gook. And that's the end of the recipe part of Xin Yi's poem. But there's a kind of hidden final instruction later on in the poem, this part where she's describing how they made paper in 2nd century China. They separated plants into individual fibers, mixed them with water, poured the result into a vat, and then
a screen of bamboo reeds was submerged into the suspension. The tangle of pulp floating to the water's surface and trapped on top of the mold resulted in a thin layer of interwoven fibers. Drained, pressed, and hung to dry, the birth of Zai Goshi.
A screen. I needed a bamboo screen. They're not very plentiful in 20th century Massachusetts, so I went to a nearby paper store and brought home the modern-day equivalent, Arnold Grummer's Pour Hand Mold, that's P-O-U-R, which came with its own set of 21 easy instructions.
Sheet press everywhere. What press? Use the press? What the hell, man?
He's no poet, Arnold Grummer, but after dipping the screen into my pool of gook, draining the water, and smushing the residue in between two pieces of cardstock...
It's coming off. It's coming off. Yeah! Paper!
Yeah, I was pretty happy about it.
I made paper. It's very thin, and it's kind of wet. But I made paper. I made paper.
I felt godlike in a way, which is weird. I mean, it's not like paper's a naturally occurring phenomenon.
Oh, yeah.
But it's so elemental somehow. So organic that it felt like I had breathed life into a pile of clay. Meantime, it took two kinds of Drano to unclog my tub. I told Xin Yi I'd call her to tell her how it went. She was in Taipei, staying about a block away from a papermaking museum. By that point, I was feeling a little remorseful about the whole screen business.
How'd it go?
Well, I feel like I cheated. Like I didn't have a bamboo screen, right?
That's fine.
So I went, you know, I went to this paper store and they sold me a screen, but like the screen came with special papermaking instructions of its own.
And you peeked at them?
I guess peeked isn't the word. I plunged into them.
Yeah.
Xin Yi is a self-proclaimed paper junkie. She used to shop a lot at that same paper store where I bought the screen. She says she wrote the poem out of appreciation for all the physical toil that went into papermaking once upon a time.
For us as writers, you know, we don't have a lot of fancy materials, I guess. You know, like, we come from a literary lineage, but this is also just sort of thinking about other artistic lineages that are connected to what we do as writers.
Xin Yi also told me that papermaking could even be seen as an analogy for poem making. It's that same attention to texture and color and detail. Actually, she didn't tell me that last part. She wrote it to me in an email.
That's Here Now, Sean Cole, finding his inner Martha. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.